Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Stoic Advantage. Today I have Greg Sadler on with us. So Greg is the current editor of Stoicism Today. After a traditional academic career of teaching, research, faculty development, and institutional leadership, he founded the company Reason.io. He started a popular philosophy YouTube channel, and he began working with clients as a certified philosophical counselor. He is the author of Reason Fulfilled by Revelation and is engaged in several book projects. His work also includes public speaking, philosophy tutorials, ethics counseling, and academic coaching. My first question I have for you is, when were you first introduced to Stoic philosophy?
So it was as an undergraduate, and so that would be early 90s or so. But I don't think that I was particularly open to it at the time. You know, we read some Epictetus in an ancient philosophy class, I think, or maybe an ethics class. We read the Enchiridion. And then I had Marcus Aurelius. I'd bought the Meditations. And, you know, I read it, but I don't think I was a very attentive reader. I was interested in the toughness part and, you know, you take responsibility for yourself. But when it came to like the justice issues or curbing your anger, things like that, I really was not paying close attention. And it was more when I was in graduate school. I got interested in Stoicism again through two main things. One was reading Epictetus' discourses, which are so much richer than the Enchiridion. And I was interested in issues of moral responsibility and how we can change ourselves, what we call the will, or the Stoics call the faculty of choice. And so how does that work and how is it structured? Epictetus had some really interesting answers to that. So that made me take Stoicism more seriously. And then as I started doing more and more research, sort of medieval approaches in philosophy about anger, I found the Stoics to be a really insightful set of resources. And so, you know, it's sort of like when you have a conversation with somebody and you realize that you misjudged them at first and you want to engage with them more. So that's sort of what happened with me. And it really was me not being particularly ready to read the Stoics at the time that I began.
So the next question I have is, why do you think Stoicism has made a comeback in popular culture over the last decade or so? This is especially true. We see a lot of popular books like The Obstacle is the Way and William B. Irvine writing about Stoicism for the popular masses. So why do you think this comeback has taken place?
Yeah, I think it's partly one of those things where once you get enough critical momentum going, people start seeing that, oh, there's a market for this. And so a lot of it depends on getting the publishers to be willing to take a chance, right? Mm-hmm. So Massimo can publish his stuff, not just because he's an established author, but because, you know, like you said, Bill Irvine published on it before. And the publishers think, oh, we can make some money on this. Yeah. So, you know, there's that commercial aspect to it. I've reviewed a few books like that in my channel. And then there's everything in between. And, you know, a lot of people are worried about Stoicism getting really watered down, but I think the better books kind of rise to the top. And, you know, even the stuff that's just kind of only tangentially connected to it helps draw attention. And then it can be like a gateway drug where you read something that's not really that well informed, and then it leads you to reading better stuff like Massimo or Donald Robertson's works or Bill Irvine or even better, people like Chris Gill and the people who have a very rigorous scholarly approach to it, which I think is not beyond the ordinary person, the way these people write their books. So that's part of it. And then, you know, we also live in a time where on the one hand, we're more and more conscious of the challenges that we're facing. So the economy is clearly unfair in any sort of justice sense and probably getting more and more unfair over this last decade. And people are facing greater and greater challenges in many aspects of their life. So there's a need side. And then because we have the internet and because it's so advanced compared to how it was, say, 20 to 15 years ago, There's a ton of resources out there to help people that they can easily search for it and find. It's not like the early days where you had like 20 different search engines and they didn't cover that much. Now, if you want to find videos on Stoicism, it's pretty easy. Just put it in Google, and or if you're, you know, really against that, DuckDuckGo and find out what pops up, right? Or I suppose if you're contrary, and Bing, you can use that search engine too. I don't know how effective it is, but so there's a couple different things kind of coming together. And then I suppose the other thing that you can say is that there's something like a self-conscious movement where, you know, we've got Stoicon and the Stoicon X's. We have important blogs out there, you know, not just Stoicism Today, but the one that Donald has on Medium, where people can write and contribute. One of the questions, interestingly, that the team keeps asking themselves, and I mean the modern Stoicism team, is have we hit what they call peak Stoic? Like, is the movement at in its growth? Is it reached the crest where now it's going to start declining? And every time that we look at the numbers, it appears that no, that's not the case. Who knows how big it's going to get? Mm-hmm. And the other thing to say is too, you know, as with any large movement, I think there's a lot of people, if you just look at the Stoicism Facebook group, there's a lot of people who are at a very beginner level and probably need to put in some more time in order to make it really effective for themselves. Mm-hmm. But that's okay.
Absolutely. Now, you teach in academia. That's one of your many jobs. In fact, I was listening to a podcast you did, I think on the Sunday Stoic, and you spoke about how you were teaching like up to maybe 8 courses in one semester or something.
Oh, yeah. That's my limit. Yes. That's the most I've done.
I can't imagine. So you teach in academia. Have you seen the same resurgence at the university level?
No. I've seen some greater interest in it. You know, academics in some sense are more progressive than the general population, but in other senses they're also very, very conservative. And not in political terms, but rather in like they think that they know the way the world works and what's important, and they don't want to change it, especially because that means like a lot of work on their part. So, you know, I think most of my peers in philosophy have only the dimmest understanding or engagement with Stoic philosophy, which is unfortunate. So they're kind of cutting themselves off by not knowing it. I will say this: I brought a few props. So one of the books that in the English speaking world has played an important role in putting Stoicism on the map academically is this: Lawrence Becker's The New Stoicism. He begins the work by saying, let's imagine that the Stoic school had never declined and disappeared for a while. What would it be like if it was a live movement today? Sort of like, you know, analytic philosophy or continental philosophy or classical American philosophy, or pick whatever you want. And so he tries to provide in this book a picture of what that would look like. And I think that this was quite important because it's so rigorous that nobody could dismiss it and say, oh, Stoicism, that's not a real philosophy. That's more or less just sort of self-help from ancient time. It allowed, you know, people to say there's really something here. And I think the thing to keep in mind is that most academics are kind of one horse ponies. They know one area that they studied and they're comfortable with that, and they specialize in it, and they don't go too far out of that. I mean, there are plenty of academics that aren't like that. I'm one of those. Massimo Pigliucci is another great example, but I would say the majority of academics are, you know, they like to stay at home. So mm-hmm. If you're the student, that means you're going into their home and you're kind of stuck with whatever they happen to cook up, you know?
Yeah,
so, absolutely. You know, if they're into beans and brats, that's what you're eating and you're stuck with it.
Yeah. No, yeah, I totally got that when I was there. I'm curious. You've mentioned Stoicon, which I was disappointed, but rightfully so because of the situation. I'm actually 2 hours from Toronto, so planning on going. So it would have been really exciting. But you're attached to a lot of Stoic organizations and initiatives. Can you get more into detail about what you're involved in besides the academic piece?
Sure. Yeah, and let me say too that Donald Robertson does plan to hold a Stoic con in Toronto once COVID is no longer an issue. So probably 2021.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't have to despair. So there's a lot of organizations out there. And I would say Modern Stoicism LTD, which is an actual like not-for-profit business organization that they've established, is one of the biggest. And they organize Stoicon, the Stoic Week class, the Stoic Mindfulness and Resilience Training class, which is just coming to a close now, and a number of other things, including, you know, the blog Stoicism Today that I edit, and the books that will be coming out from that. There's two volumes that Patrick Usher brought out, and then I'm working with another colleague on bringing forth some other edited volumes. And so there's all of that activity, and they, you know, all the people involved in it, you know, the old expression, if you want something done, ask a busy person, because then they, you know, they can get tasks done. All of us involved in it are volunteers, and we all put in quite a bit of work and time. And there's about 10 of us on that thing, but it, you know, it trickles down to a lot of other people. And then another really important organization that's developed in the last 5 years is the Stoic Fellowship. The Stoic Fellowship exists to help to promote face-to-face groups so that you meet in person, and, you know, it could be weekly, it could be monthly. You talk, you know, there's all sorts of different approaches that one can take, and it's really cool to be connected all over the world like that. And then each of those has the potential for having its own little Stoic on X, which is, you know, sort of like TED and TEDx, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of a cool thing to do. What else? I mean, there's another group called the Traditional Stoics, and they don't approve of some of the, you know, in their view, too many concessions to modernity that the modern Stoics make, and they kind of do their thing off on the side, but there's quite a few of them, and they have their own College of Stoic Philosophers, which allows people to be ordained as a Stoic philosopher minister. I don't actually have any connection with them, although I've met some of them. And yeah, there's a number of other smaller groups and organizations. And I think the key thing is that they're all devoted to providing people opportunities, not just to learn about and practice Stoicism, but to do so in relation to each other, to connect together. And I think that's really important, because when we look at Stoic philosophy, one of the things that they hammer home over and over and over again is that we are social creatures. We're not supposed to be, you know, the ideal of the Stoic is not the ascetic who goes off by him or herself into the desert, never talks to anybody, keeps the, you know, maintains this whatever we want to call it, or inner citadel, nobody gets in. It's instead of somebody who is affectionate with their fellow human beings, who can stand up against injustice when it's taking place and identify it, but not allow themselves to get wrapped up in cycles of violence or anger, who fulfills their duties, and in general, you know, sort of like the old metaphor of the salt of the earth, a good Stoic would be the salt of the earth. And so having these organizations is really an important way to further that, I think.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of alluded to a Stoic myth, the idea of someone who just goes off and lives the principles to themselves. I'm curious, what are some other Stoic myths that you feel have circulated over time and which you wish to dispel?
Yeah, well, so the Stoics are all about suppressing their emotions is probably the biggest one. You know, the idea that Mr. Spock on Star Trek is like the ideal Stoic. It pops up over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. The Stoics were not about removing or suppressing or you know, pushing down your emotions. That's kind of a losing strategy in dealing with your emotions. Instead, like the other virtue ethicists, so Aristotelians, Platonists, Epicureans, they thought that you need to actually understand the way your emotions work. So they provide some guidance about that. If we want to be fully realized as human beings, if we want to, you know, be in accordance with nature the way the Stoics meant it, one of them is love or affection for those that who were connected to. So I think that's one of the biggest myths. You mentioned, well, we talked about the setting up the armor or the inner citadel. The Stoic is not somebody who's totally withdrawn from other people. And what else? There's the version of Stoicism watered down that we often jokingly call Broicism, where these people, you know, take the mythological red pill and understand that society is, you know, against them or whatever other, you know, so-called revelations they have. I mean, a lot of times it's a good question. What are these myths? We run into them in those small groups because people come in and they're like, I think Stoicism means this. And we're like, well, that's not what the texts actually say. Or, you know, if you think that through, that's not really going to work. But no others come to mind as being particularly egregiously wrong mm-hmm. as those three. Yeah. But we might, you know, maybe some others will come to mind as we're going through it. Yeah.
I'm curious, going back to your job as an academic, someone who teaches students, do you believe Stoicism could help young people?
So yeah, I think it can be very helpful. Again, I'm not a great example because when I was a young person, I took from Stoicism only the stuff that I thought would be useful for me and didn't turn out to be that useful. But yeah, man, being able to understand how emotions arise, that we're not simply their prey, that you know, we don't just feel things that then we automatically have to respond to. I think that can be incredibly helpful for people. Stoicism can help you, you know, in reading what these great thinkers have to say with what we call values clarification, figuring out what's really important for you in your life. And, you know, there's a lot of, I would say, a lot of aspects of ordinary life that Stoicism can provide a structured and intentional response to. So, you know, if you're fortunate enough to grow up with the sort of everybody gets a gold star for doing everything coddling, when you run into real problems and then you can't handle them, Stoicism can be something that fills in the gap. And I also think that if you're not the spectrum, but a young person who's maybe been quite traumatized by you know, classism or racism or sexism or just being stuck with abusive people, Stoicism isn't like a magic bullet that will automatically protect you, but it certainly can help you wrap your head around what's going on and then, you know, be able to at certain points apply useful practices. So I think there's a huge wide range of application. It can also be very liberating as a young person to find out that not only that the older people who are continually giving you advice often don't know what they're talking about and have their own values kind of mixed up, but that there's also other yet older people who actually did have their heads on straight, and in comparison to which the older people that you're looking at from your vantage point are actually children, you know? So maybe having the Stoics around, like having Seneca in your camp, allows you to stand up to the pressure of having all the old people tell you that you got things wrong and you're too soft or alternately too hard or stuff like that. So, I mean, I think actually that's a great topic, and I'd be interested to hear what these other people have to say.
I'm a teacher myself, and I'm fascinated by how Stoic philosophy can help just with mindfulness and mindset when it comes to teaching, because I find that there's so many books out there that deal with pedagogy, which is great, but there's not a lot that deal with kind of teacher mindfulness. And I think that Stoicism could really fill that gap and help. So that's something I'm kind of writing about myself as well and trying to figure out.
Yeah. That and the same things can apply to teachers, you know, like when we have students who are kind of jerks to us, what do? You know, we can realize it doesn't really have anything to do with us.
This is a question that I like asking all my guests on here. It's what books have had the biggest impact on your life? So they could be Stoic related or non-Stoic related, obviously.
Yeah, I've done a couple like talks with other people interviewing me about this. You need good models for how things would work out in terms of the virtues. So Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics is a book I go back to all the time. I won't say that Aristotle has everything right, but he's certainly somebody who you could say is, like, you know, in the back of my head as an interlocutor. Epictetus's discourses has been very important for me as well. He's probably my favorite of the Stoics. Seneca's written more, you know, Marcus Aurelius, there's a lot of cool things about him, but Epictetus is really my guy. And then, you know, Plato's Republic is quite good as well. But I've been influenced by a lot of other works, some of which are just works of fiction. You know, Dostoevsky's work has been pretty important for me. I'm a big fan of Philip K. Dick. I think that he's one of the people, at least in my reading, who's quite excellent at taking ideas coming from philosophy, particularly from ethics and metaphysics, from religion, from psychology, and putting them into the minds and the dialogue of his characters, and then their choices and actions. And it's not as if you could, like, read his works and, like, automatically learn philosophy, but you get to see how it's actually applied in life. So, yeah, I mean, it's tough to say. Because yeah. I'm kind of, you know, I'm less of a, I got influenced by this person and then, like, became a follower and then just everything kept on going on. It's more like being a mosaic of stones drawn from, like, mm-hmm. a couple hundred different quarries, you know.
No, and I think that's normal too, right? Kind of having, like, this buffet table of various writers that have influenced you instead of just, you know, I'm a Platonist. Like, I don't think that's very healthy to just, you know, declare yourself a follower of one or two authors.
Yeah. I mean, if it does work out for somebody psychologically, I guess that's okay. It's nice. It's the sort of thing, good work if you can get it, you know, when mm-hmm. somebody would advise some almost utopian thing, we'd be like, well, I mean, if that actually happens in life, it's great, but that never happens in anybody's lives that I know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do know some people who are, you could say, one book cranks, but that's less of a good thing, you know, and more of a deficit on their part. They think that somehow everything is contained within this one thing or this one author. And what's bad about them is that they end up being really tiresome, you know? Everything becomes just about Aristotle. Mm-hmm. Thomists are bad for that too. Thomas Aquinas knew everything. You just have to find the right passage in the Summa, and Thomas has the answer, you know?
Yeah. Okay, great. I'm curious. I like asking this question as well. What advice would you give your younger self if you were able to?
You know, I got asked that in another interview lately, and I realized that that's actually a really great question. And I had to think about it a bit because there were so many different ways I was screwed up as a kid and then an adolescent and a young man. I think the most useful advice that I would give myself would be that 90% of the things that you think are important and people are going to judge you for are actually unimportant and won't have any real effect, and everyone's going to forget about it within, you know, a short time after whatever happens. And so you don't have to take things quite so seriously and feel things like anxiety or irritation. And I think I would have not only made different choices that probably would have been better in the long run, but I wouldn't have had to go through so much negative emotion. You know, I would have freed myself up for things. Yeah. So a lot of conflicts too. A lot of conflicts that we get into, we think that they're important and they really don't matter that much. You know, mm-hmm. 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're not going to be talking with those people. Who cares what they think? You know?
Yeah. No, for sure. I know a book that helped me a lot understand that was, even though I wasn't a big fan of the writing, was The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F by Mark Manson. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's a big self-help popular book, but
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a bit to get into with all the swearing at the beginning, but basically it's that idea of the thesis is we only have so many things to care about and we should be careful. We shouldn't just care about the smallest things because, like you said, 10 years from now, will we even be associated with that person? Will that decision even matter? Probably not. So just don't get tied up with those things. So for sure, I wish that was something I knew when I was younger as well, especially receiving grades in school that you're like, oh, I wish I could have gotten 5% higher. Does that really matter in the long run?
I was going to ask you, so as a teacher, you know, when you first start out, you want to make like your class the best class ever and this sort of thing. And so you design your exercise and these learning goals or objectives or whatever language mm-hmm. they're using at the time, because that changes every 5 years too. Yeah. And, you know, your students cycle through, and after a while they're gone from whatever institution you're in, mm-hmm. right? Because they've moved on. I wonder if teaching after a while, if you don't just get burnt out, if teaching by in that situation where you have these things cycling through, classes, cohorts, whatever you want to say, if that would help to drive that home, that a lot of this stuff isn't really that important. If they don't get it, you know, here, maybe they'll get it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. We don't have to have every single student be a success story.
Yeah.
And we don't have that much control over that anyway. I mean, all we can do is sort of set the buffet up and encourage them not to eat the junk food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even they might not even be ready. If you're reading a certain text, they might not even be ready for it to speak to them at that time. It may take 5 to 10 years from now. I read The Great Gatsby in grade 12 and I'm like, it didn't really do anything. And then 5 to 10 years later, I'm like, oh, wow. Well, you know, it's really moved me in such a way. So it just might not even be their time to even get anything out of it that's productive for them.
And there's so many contingent things. I mean, one of my strongest memories of like middle school English class with a teacher who I really liked, as we were reading some poem, and I don't even remember who the poem was by, but it was about a bull in the pasture, and it was like smelling the cows in heat, and there was like some line about the bull's balls. And of course, as like seventh graders, we're all like laughing at this, right? Because we're learning about sexuality and who we are and stuff like that. And she wanted us to take it seriously as like an actual poem. She was very upset, you know, very angry, stormed out of the classroom, had to come back in a little bit later. And it really, that very much impressed us that we were taking this the wrong way, but we didn't know how we were supposed to take it. Mm-hmm. And then I think about stuff like that later on when I have students who are kind of screwing around in class, you know, and I'm like, well, you know, I did that too. So I can understand why they're doing that. Let's see if we can possibly steer them back towards what we want. But I mean, if you think about like, that's the strongest memory that I have of English class throughout all of my K through 12.
Yes. You
know? So contingent and very little to learn from it, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. Yeah. I know an exercise that I use is I oftentimes pretend that I'm a student in my own class, and I pretend to be in that perspective of their age. And I think, would I have enjoyed the class I was just in? And I'm like, if I didn't, then I don't really blame them for possibly, you know, just kind of having their head in the air and not really thinking and being attentive to the lessons. So, you know, I think especially at this time where we have a lot of online learning and students maybe not engaging or struggling, you think, well, if I was in that position myself, I could probably be dealing with the same thing. So
I often was the bad student, so I can draw on all of those sorts of memories.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe before I get to this question, my last question, I'm curious, right now we're dealing with a couple things, within the world. The first thing obviously is the pandemic. The second thing is what's going on in the United States. Can Stoicism help with any of this in terms of helping our mindsets or helping us get through this time?
Yeah, I think it can, as it can with any sort of crisis. You know, when we're thinking about how things, modes of intentional living like Stoicism would help us, we have like the problems that are chronic, and then we have problems that are acute, right? And sometimes they kind of overlap with each other. So the chronic problems oftentimes are matters of prioritization and mindset and changing our habit and getting some insight about what we're doing and, you know, figuring out who we want to be connected with and who are bad influence in whatever way that we want to disconnect from. And then we have, you know, particularly acute problems like the protests and you know, police responses and where should we fit in with things. And you know, a great example of this is those who put up black screens, you know, because they wanted to be allies of one sort or another, and then got told by Black Lives Matter, hey, you're actually like interfering, you're getting in the way, take your stupid black screens down. Now, you know, what's your response to that? You could be like, oh, who, you know, I was trying to help them out and, you know, look at how they're treating me, screw them, you know, that would not be a stoic response. A stoic would be attentive to the needs of the other person and ask, well, is this reasonable? Why am I particularly invested in this rather than, say, bringing water to marches and protests, you know? If I feel very strongly about this sort of thing. And, you know, Stoicism helps us to analyze why we have the responses that we do. And, you know, it's also good too. And I don't think it's just Stoicism that does this. There's other, like I said, modes of intent living that help us with this. Making the right distinctions. You know, people are like, being very simple-minded about what's happening. And they're like, you know, all cops are bastards. Well, no, they're not all bastards. They certainly, you know, can be, you know, pretty bad when they're put together and given riot gear and have bad leadership. And, you know, quite a few of them already have, you know, willingness to crack heads or malice in their heart. And then, you know, you have to figure out what you're going to do with your fellow cops, but they're not all this way. And likewise, the protesters, I mean, the majority of them are not looting or doing anything wrong. And you know, the people who are like engaging in these blanket condemnations, I think a stoic can keep them falling into those traps. And then, you know, being able to maintain several different thoughts in one's head at the same time that don't all map on to each other. That's, you know, that's part of what it means to be a rational person. Mm-hmm. So I think it can be helpful with that. It can be helpful with the you know, the COVID thing. You know, like for example, should you wear a mask when you're going outside and are going to be, you know, lined up with other people? Probably so. Do we know 100% certain, you know, with like, so all sorts of scientific studies to back us up? Well, the evidence is, you know, more on one side than on the other, but a reasonable person would say, okay, I don't want to take the risk of putting myself in danger or those around me. So being just would mean doing this, and being prudent would mean selecting the best means, like say a mask and avoiding people who don't have masks. So I think it's not as if Stoicism would have like one main way in which it helps people deal with this stuff, but it would be a whole bunch of smaller things that kind of fit together in a systematic way of approaching matters. And it would also help us to be less aggressive, less angry, less, you know, clapping back at people who we think have things wrong, because we can say, well, they obviously have some sort of cognitive mistake that they've made, and you know, we can certainly like try to say, hey, you should think about this, but you know, we don't control them. So some people are just never going to listen. It's all about, say, their liberties. I think if you have an armed protester who's, you know, against wearing a mask, who's willing to carry, you know, a rifle into a courthouse, you're not going to reach that person. And you're probably not going to reach your crazy aunt who gets all of her information from Fox News either, you know, and that's okay. You know, it's not good that you can't convince them that maybe they should care about other people in different ways. They probably care about some people, but just not as they ought to. But you know, nobody said that you were going to be the person to save the world either. So again, Stoicism can help out with that sort of thing, I think, quite a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Last question I have is, what is next for Greg Sadler?
So a lot of that is just me kind of grinding away at the stuff that I already do, you know, more videos, more podcast episodes, working with clients, doing the radio show. We have here in Milwaukee, we have a community radio station that one of the co-organizers of the Stoic Fellowship, the local chapter here, he and I have been doing a weekly radio show, and we're actually recording an episode tonight. Other than that, you know, I've got a kid who's about to go off to college, so that's pretty exciting. Although we don't know whether she'll be doing online or actual face-to-face. And trying to get in shape. I'm just sort of like moving along the same trajectory. I don't have any really big new projects or plans in mind.
Well, I appreciate, Greg, you taking the time to come on to the Stoic Advantage. And is there any last words you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, I think if people are interested in Stoicism, I do want to stress that meeting with other people locally, and I understand that right now saying this in the environment we're in, obviously we can't meet locally, right? But that actually has other opportunities. So once this COVID thing is done, it really is to your advantage to try to find local groups that you can do this with, not just to do it totally on your own. And now that we're in this environment where we're doing everything online, you can actually get involved in those local groups because they're all doing things on Zoom. For our Milwaukee Stoic Fellowship, we have people coming in from Arizona and Iowa and Florida. So it's a great time to do a little bit of internet research and find people who you can connect with and then, you know, learn more about Stoicism from.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Greg, and I hope to have you back on in the future.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.